And would someone like to move the minutes of February 22nd? I see Representative Johnson moving the minutes of February 22nd. Are there any corrections or any discussion? Oh, we do not yet have a quorum. So, Representative Johnson, I appreciate your eagerness. If you could just hold on a minute. And now I'm being told that we do have a quorum. So, Representative Johnson, would you like to renew your motion? Great. Is there any discussion on the minutes of February 22nd? All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? Motion carries. And next on our agenda is House File 1200. And Representative Kranz, would you like to move your bill to the consent calendar?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move it to the consent calendar, House File 1200.
Great. Thank you, Representative Kranz. And to your bill.
Well, I do have a couple of testifiers, I believe. And just for the members, I think this is something that's pretty common. Mr. Speaker, this is the revisers bill, which basically corrects any of the errors that they found along the way, streamlines the process, hopefully gets us to get our job done on time. So within that, I'll have the introduction of any bill. I think, has all the members gotten a copy of this?
Representative Kranz, I believe
maybe we could. Yeah,
I believe that every member should have the bill in their packet.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if we can just move right to questions for the sake of time, or would you like an overview of this?
I think, Representative, just a quick overview.
Okay.
And the testifier, if you could identify yourself for the record, and thank you for coming before the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, and I'm the reviser of statutes, and I'm here today on behalf of the annual revisers bill, which is in your packet. As many of you know, the revisers bill is a bill that is prepared annually. What happens is that during the interim between sessions, the revisers office does substantial editing and with the publishing of the session laws and the statutes. We often find things from past sessions that are errors or are in need of correction. And because we do this annually, we also get requests from state agencies, from members, from other colleagues in House Research and Senate Counsel to make non-controversial corrections in the revisers bill. And we actually tend to have two bills that are often confused. This one comes early in the session, and it's correcting errors from past years. Way at the end of session, one of the last bills you will probably consider is something that we call the corrections bill, for purposes of trying to not confuse the two. That bill is to correct errors that happen in the session that we're in. And so what we try to do is keep the corrections in this bill to very non-controversial, non-substantive items, things that are really just cleanup. The corrections bill at the end of session, though, can be very different. Think about a reversal of digits in a numerical entry in a bill. That could be very substantive. So we use a very different process for that bill, where the chairs of each committee that's involved actually sign off on it. For this one, because it's really a cleanup bill, the process that we use is that during the interim in the early part of session, we compile all the minor errors that we found, but that are beyond what we believe we can correct with simply editorial authority, compile them into a bill, do a draft. Then we have the draft reviewed by House Research and Senate Counsel. In House Research, Deb Dyson reviewed this bill, and in Senate Counsel, Kathy Pontius reviewed this bill. This year they happen to have no suggested changes. The bill itself, as I said, is a compilation of correction of different errors and problems. The first article, it has three articles. The first article contains general provisions, many of which correct terminology. Or drafting errors. We often have names that have changed, the names of a particular agency. And we need to go in and make those changes. You can understand that that's very common. Article 2 deals with obsolete and conflicting provisions. And we have a number of obsolete provisions that need to be repealed. I guess I should also mention that another thing we do that's different with this bill is that the revisor's office prepares an explanation of each and every one of these changes. And so we've done that, and I hope that that is also in your packets, our memorandum of explanation. Getting back to the structure of the bill itself, there is a third article, and that contains a number of errors and cross-references. As you can understand, as we renumber things, as we renumber provisions, many times when we get to the editing phase, we find that cross-references in other sections no longer point to the right provision. So those are things that we need to correct. And with that, I believe that's the overview of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Timmons. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Questions, members? I know this is an exciting and glamorous topic. Seeing no questions, I just want to express the committee's appreciation for the unglamorous and tedious work that I know goes into preparing these bills.
Thank you. And I just this morning, as we had an all-staff meeting, we were talking about the bill drafting numbers, and this year in 2007, we were running about 2 weeks ahead of where we were in 2005, which was a record pace for a long session. So we're busy.
I trust that you are. And any other questions? Representative Kranz, would you like to renew your motion to pass House File 1200, or to recommend passage of House File 1200 and move it to the consent calendar?
Yes, I would.
Great. Motion is renewed. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Motion prevails.
The next bill up on the calendar for today is the criminal element, the tax department, or Department of Revenue. Representative Lesh and Rick, do you want to come up? Representative Lesh, I believe your bill would have to go to the tax committee.
Okay.
Would it not? Do you know, Jack?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think these are technical data practices stuff, so it should only implicate the civil law aspect of this committee.
Okay.
It comes from the department, but I don't think it necessarily has to go.
At one point, they had told me that they thought it went to tax, but
Mr. Chairman, I have not spoken with Chairman Lanchesky about it, but in the past, it has not always gone to the tax committee, so it's really, I suppose, sort of called.
Oh, okay.
Why don't I try and see if I can get an answer here in the next couple of minutes?
Okay, why don't you do that and then just proceed with your bill, Representative Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a Department of Revenue disclosure bill, and you have a summary of it in your packets, and I'm going to, of the 5 seconds, just allow Rick Walzer to explain them.
Mr. Walzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Rick Walzer. I'm a staff attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I'll summarize these 5 sections. Section 1 adds the motor vehicle sales tax chapter to the list of taxes that are covered by Chapter 270B. Occasionally the department does handle motor vehicle sales tax appeals or claims for refunds, so that's why we're making this change. Section 2 clarifies existing law that informant data under Chapter 270B does not include property tax. We're merely striking an existing clause and making that clause a separate sentence. Section 3 is a new subdivision in Chapter 270B. The Department of Revenue collects non-tax government debts under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 16D, and this provision clarifies that when the department is collecting these non-tax government debts, that our collection division can use tax information for that purpose. Section 4 has to do with the JobZ and biotech zone program. As I'm sure a lot of you are aware, this program involves three different government entities. It involves the local government unit where the business is located. It involves the Department of Economic Development, and it involves the Department of Revenue because we are the one who grants the tax reduction benefits. And this provision merely clarifies that the Department of Revenue can share tax information with these other entities to administer that program. And then finally, Section B has to do with certification of Class 1B homestead classification. This is for blind and disabled homeowners. Under current law, those forms are filed with the Department of Revenue, but the reason that the forms in the past were filed with the Department of Revenue is because there was income information on these forms, and there no longer is any income information, so this section transfers the function to the counties. And the only reason this provision is in this data practices bill is because there's a sentence in this section that says that Social Security numbers that are on these forms and any income or medical information that's on these forms is all classified as private data on individuals. And that concludes my summary.
Representative Lesh, do you have any more testimony, or should we ask for questions?
I don't think any more comments, Mr. Chairman, from the fact that these changes are technical in nature for the most part. Some may, I suppose, find exception to that, but no other comments.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, can you tell me what local officials would need to, I'm talking about Section 4, what local officials would need as far as information, and which is it counties, cities? I mean, that's really broad language to enforce. You know, you say an appropriate officials from local government units. And I mean, I'm just concerned that that's the window's too wide open there. And so talk to me a little bit about how this works, who has to look at what, and if there's any opportunities to narrow that down at all.
Okay. Do you want Representative Lesh or Mr. Walls?
Well, it's his bill, but
okay.
Whoever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, yes, I expect there's a story behind this, which I don't know that story, so I would defer to Mr. Walser on that if I could.
Mr. Walser.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one example of where we would be sharing information, there's a provision in the JobZ statute that says that the Commissioner of Revenue, in consultation with the Department of Economic Development and the local government unit, can waive the repayment provisions if a business that's been granted job Z status prematurely moves out of the zone. So that's one example. We initially had the language drafted just for that precise situation, but we were concerned that there could be other situations that arise where we would need to exchange information. So we wanted to have it have a little flexibility because there's several pages of laws involved with administering the program. So that's why it's drafted like it is.
Representative Fulbert.
And Mr. Chair, in the scenario that he just laid forward, it sounds like the commissioner has the ultimate authority. It's in consultation with, and so I don't understand why you would share this data with the local unit of government when the commission and the department, commissioner and the department, make the decision. So in other words, if the main decision maker already has access to this information, why do you have to share it with the local unit of government when they're not the final word?
Mr. Walzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if a business breaks their covenant and moves out of the zone prematurely, the Department of Revenue, there's no decision to be made. I mean, the Department of Revenue is charged with the responsibility of recovering these taxes. The decision I'm talking about is to waive repayment, and that is not the commissioner's sole decision. The statute provides that it's in consultation with these other entities. And so we don't necessarily know that a business has prematurely moved out of the zone. The local government authority is going to tell us that. But we need to be able to disclose, yes, there is this tax debt that the department can recover under the law, but here's why it's not a good idea to try and collect the debt in this situation, and that's why the statute provides for a three-way consultation.
Are there any other questions? Okay, then Representative Lush, I forgot about the fact that this is part of the data practices, so this will be laid over for possible inclusion in the data practices bill that we would have from this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The next bill is Representative Carlson.
Yeah.
Just one. And
the people who are going to be the witnesses for this bill are presenting this very bill in the Senate. Be over. That was first on their agenda.
Okay, we'll try that then. Representative Hillstrom, you are up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 503 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee.
Representative Hillstrom, do you want to present your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House File 503 is a bill that was brought to me by the Attorney General's Office, so I have them here with me. It makes it a crime to use the Internet to solicit children to engage in sexual conduct, communicate with children in a sexually explicit manner, or distribute sexually explicit material to children, and it provides penalties. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Voigt.
Thank you.
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair. I'm David Voigt, an Assistant Attorney General. The Attorney General is proposing this bill because the Internet gives such easy access to children, to predators out there. Now, we currently prohibit under Minnesota law, the solicitation of a child to engage in sexual conduct. But a very common scenario that law enforcement investigators see and that victims experience is that over the internet, before there's any actual solicitation, there is grooming behavior. Behavior such as talking to the child in a sexually explicit manner, perhaps distributing pornography to the child, and this behavior can be precursor behavior to actual sexual conduct. And one of the dangers of the internet is that due to its the anonymity it provides, you just don't know whether the person who's communicating with the child in that manner is a person that's going to follow through or is going to stop with the sexually explicit communications. So this proposal would prohibit not just actual solicitation, which is also prohibited, or which is already prohibited, but it would prohibit sexually explicit communication and distribution of pornography to minors over the internet.
Thank you, Mr. Voigt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also with me is Detective Craig Martin from the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office.
Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been a detective with Hennepin County Sheriff's Office for numerous years. And part of my job is to pose undercover in these numerous different chat rooms as a minor. And I've had numerous investigations which have led to conversations with numerous people on the internet. And one such case that I had involved a convicted sex offender here in Minnesota that was chatting with an actual minor in the state of Illinois. And through the investigation, there was proof of the chat that had occurred. And unfortunately, local law enforcement with myself and the state and federal attorneys were unable to prosecute this individual under the current laws that we have. So I think that I'm here to implore you that it is an important bill at your hands, and this happens quite frequently. Every time I get online, I'm solicited for sex, and it's every single time. And I usually pose as a 13, 14, or 15-year-old girl, depending on my mood that day. So, believe me, it depends on what exactly you got going on in your undercover story. So, it happens all the time, and it does not matter to the people on the other end what your age you are. So, this is a very important bill for law enforcement.
And for
the protection of our children.
Detective Martin, if you're posing as a 15-year-old, the bill wouldn't cover, I believe.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a child means a person 15 years of age or younger. So as long as
he's 15 of age or younger.
Then
I'm sorry.
That okay. It
does. Do you have any more?
That's it,
witnesses, is there any testimony to the contrary? Okay. The first thing I've got the question. Were you able to work out the language that I pointed out was a problem? And that right now under this, if the person, let's say an adult from another state, sends out this message or whatever it is and is told, let's say it's a child, but they put on their mother's picture and age and different things like that, under the present language, they would be convicted under this statute, even though the person was acting on the belief that they were acting over the internet with an adult.
Mr. Chair, if I could defer to David Voigt from the Attorney General's Office.
Thank you,
Voigt.
Mr. Chair, essentially the new language mirrors the language that's already in the statute for solicitation of a minor to engage in sexual conduct. And that, the statute as it exists right now, already prohibits a solicitation over the internet. Our expansion broadens that a little bit, but the statute does provide for strict liability. If you're going to solicit a person for sex under the current statute, you better know how old that person is, because you're going to be held to strict liability. And I guess the question under the expansion of that is, if you're going to communicate explicitly on the internet with somebody, do you want strict liability? Should that person know who they're communicating with? As far as the scenario that you bring up, a person, an adult, communicating in a sexually explicit manner with a child who is pretending to be another adult, that is a situation where strict liability may cause a problem for that adult. But as a prosecutor, I just haven't heard of that scenario coming up, and perhaps Officer Nelson, who actually investigates these offenses, has a different perspective, but I just haven't heard of that scenario.
Detective Martin?
Mr. Chairman, in my experience, these usually the first opening line that anybody communicates with each other on in these types of investigation is an acronym ASL, age, sex, location. And so that's usually one of the first things that's covered right out of the chute, almost, I would guess, 90% of the time. They want to know how old you are, they want to know where you're from, and usually just a general location is fine. But if you tell them that you're 14 years old or 13 years old, I've had some people, will once they find out that you're that age, they'll disappear. But quite frequently, the people that are involved in perpetrating on young children are interested in that age, and they are the ones that will continue to conversate with you, and which leads into your sexual language.
Well, Officer or Detective Martin, it would seem that if we're trying to get the ones who are interested in people of that age, they would be the ones that would respond that way. So why are we trying to get the ones that fool them? And why are we trying to get the ones that are targeting in it? Maybe we should totally exclude it for everybody, for adults, but that's what you're in essence doing, because you would be saying, if the person over here thinks this person is 40 and therefore they want to go ahead and do this, then you would be saying you can't do that because you might be strictly liable. I'm used to strict liability under, you know, tort and different things. Civil law, it seems pretty strange that if we're targeting people who want to go after children, that we are then, or somebody tries to exclude children and is fooled, why are we going after them then?
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that, actually. I was not aware that it was currently in law for the solicitation already, and so because it's the same under someone who is soliciting, they better know if they're soliciting for sex, that person is older. So this would be no different than current statute. So I guess I would prefer that it stay as it is.
Well, Representative Hilster, I don't have time to check the statute on exactly what it is, Representative Holbrook.
Well, and Mr.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. There's a list of them. Representative Holbrook.
Okay.
I haven't seen the others. Representative Bigham, Lesh, Simon, and Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to applaud Representative Hilstrom for bringing this forward, and applaud the Attorney General Swanson for doing this. This is a very important bill, and it's not so much a question but just a comment that this is a great initiative. The other thing is this morning as I was determining what to TiVo, Dateline How to Catch a Predator is on tonight. So those that show is dealing with this type of legislation, and it's really an interesting program to watch, just to see how the legal system works amongst this type of kind of unique crime, because it's dealing with, you know, the web and, you know, kind of interstate stuff, as you said, Officer Martin. So, again, Representative Hillstrom, thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, one for Mr. Voigt and another for Detective Martin. First, for Mr. Voigt, can you state a similar type of law that you currently use, which has similar kinds of elements to prove? As I read through this thing and I think about it, were I a defense attorney, what I would go after, do you have similar other types of laws that you yourself prosecute or other people in your division prosecute that would require similar type of proof elements, and what are those laws or offenses?
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, do you mean types of offenses that get at similar conduct?
That get at the similar type of specific intent statements. So as you stated, there were strict liability implications. I'm wondering, it strikes me that this poses a whole flurry of situations that if I were a defense attorney, I would come in and offer, you know, mistake of fact or what have you. So yes, similar types of fact patterns that would fall under this.
Well, Representative, Mr. Chair, I would point to the criminal sexual conduct statutes, which by providing that mistake of age is not a defense, imposes strict liability for having sexual contact or sexual penetration with the child.
Okay.
Representative
Well, I didn't necessarily have a follow-up on that, but I did have a question for Detective Martin as well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question to that point? Representative Lesh's question?
Representative De La Force, to the point.
Thank you. I wanted to follow up, Mr. Voigt, to Representative Lesh's question. Perhaps I missed it, but as I read this on lines 2.3 and 2.4, the prosecutor has a job of sort of a double mens rea requirement. You have to prove that the person perhaps in some circumstances reasonably believes there's a child, and then you have to prove they have the intent to arouse or gratify the person. And I'm not really familiar with the criminal statutes. Do prosecutors have, are there similar statutes where they have to prove sort of this dual mens rea requirement to prove guilt? I think that's perhaps what Representative Lesh was asking. I'm just curious.
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the intent element is there in order to avoid communications perhaps between parent and son or daughter, between medical professionals and children, with the idea that if the intent of the adult is to arouse or gratify sexual desire, it doesn't matter what the relationship is in the communication. Now back to the more general question, are there other statutes that require two separate intents? Yes, there are. For example, felony murder, a murder in the course of a robbery requires both an intent to kill and an intent to commit the robbery. So there are other statutes with more than one intent that needs to be proved.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. Voigt, I have a follow-up to your point. you mentioned criminal sexual conduct, but that's in person. And it's a lot easier to know if somebody's under 15 if you're in person than it is over the internet. I don't see much connection between those. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Detective Martin. Detective Martin, in the current situation where you got a guy like you did in Minnesota who's soliciting an individual or a minor in Illinois, and right now our hands are tied and we can't do anything, do you keep this guy on a hot list or a watch list or something? I mean, even though we don't have any laws we can charge, we can prosecute the guy under, what do we do with a guy like that now, currently? Okay, well, answer what you can. Yeah.
Detective Martin.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh. It's very difficult because every time I get on the internet, I got guys, I got people all over me. It's really literally crazy how many people are soliciting me at any given time. Yes, for that individual circumstance in which you gave me, we try to keep him a little under the radar, communication with his parole officer, probation officer, things like that, so we can do a little more regular checkups on his computer. People like that are going to be a little more savvy next time they do this, but that would certainly, it'd be nice to have a thumb on everybody, but it's extremely difficult. There are a lot of people like this.
So, quick follow-up, Mr.
Representative. So, if this guy, for example, was on paper, probation or whatever, are we ensuring that judges have something like this as violations of conditions of their probation, even though it currently isn't against the law?
Detective Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lash, depending on their release from, you know, the conditions of release, various people have different conditions, so this particular person did not fit into the criteria for revoking him and sending him back into custodial status, into a prison setting. So I guess it would be a case-by-case basis. There are, obviously, for people that are released out of prison, yeah, there's some safeguards to it. But as far as communication with judges, it usually happens on the police, parolee, probation officer level until it goes up to a higher step. I don't know if that answered your question, sir.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, thanks to the Attorney General's office and thanks to Representative Hellstrom for being a champion for this issue. I think it's important. I think it's a great idea. I just want to make sure we do it right. And so I want to first touch upon the Chair's concern and see if I understand his concern by way of a hypothetical. Let's say a man, Joe Blow, goes on Match.com, totally conventional legal internet dating service, goes on there and strikes up a conversation with someone who he believes is 37 years old. The photo says that. That's what the profile says. And after several emails back and forth, the conversation turns into a sexually explicit conversation. And then he finds out it's not a 37-year-old. It's really a 13-year-old. Under this statute as it's written right now, are we avoiding that, or would that possibly come within the boundaries of the statute? And Mr. Chair, is that the type of hypothetical
you're Representative Simon, that's exactly what I'm criticizes being too law and order a lot, but this is going awful far in my mind to where what are we going to next? Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, theoretically, the scenario that you just described, if it came to the attention of authorities and if a prosecutor reviewed that and decided that the person should be charged, theoretically, that person could be charged. Just a couple of points. Number one, it's one of the dangers of the internet is that it provides for anonymity, and there is a danger that you may be talking to a person that you're not sure you're talking to. And another one of the dangers is that children go out on the internet, and this bill, I guess, is about protecting children. And the other point is that with this statute, as with all others, there's prosecutorial discretion that probably would prevent that particular case from being prosecuted.
Okay. That's what I thought you were going to say, but I just...
Yeah, Representative Mo.
The record.
Representative Morley, if I could add something to that comment, since as a former 32-year prosecutor, I might be able to shed some light. In the example Mr. Simon used, I would guess that I wouldn't charge it because the guy didn't go on there thinking he was dealing with a 13- or 14-year-old. The one that the statute is meant for is the individual that advertises their 13 or 14 that you're dealing with. Is that not correct?
That is... I'm sorry.
Yes, that is what the statute is aimed for.
Well, Representative Simon, are you continuing on that point?
Yes, please. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I thought that's what you were going to say. That yes, technically, that would come within the statute, the Match.com example, but that as a practical reality, that's not the kind of thing that a prosecutor would pursue. I guess that's just something we have to live with in a statute like this and others, unless you believe there's some comfort language we can find to lay those fears. I would defer to you. I love the idea. I just want to make sure that we're not... not throwing something out there that might cause, you know, a court or someone else to invalidate it for vagueness, perhaps, or something like that. That's all.
Mr. Chair, actually, the detective has something that he'd like to add as well.
Detective Martin.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, in my experience in undercover chat, your scenario is excellent. However, I've never seen it ever happen. It just doesn't happen. And plus, the bill mentions a reasonable belief. If that person in your scenario in dealing with Joe Blow on Match.com, if that person were actively looking for, say, a dating relationship with a party, and they actually found out that this was actually a child, I believe that that person, your Joe Blow, would turn tail and run. My experience is that people are actively looking for minors and soliciting them, and I think that's what this bill is addressing.
Representative Simon?
And I'm willing to accept the answer on prosecutorial discretion, since there are a lot of things which technically could be prosecuted which just plain aren't. I would say, though, that in terms of the bill, I don't think that necessarily gets us off the hook there, because it does say in several instances on 2.3, 2.6, 2.8, and 2.10, there's a choice. It's either communicating or doing this stuff to a child or someone that they reasonably believe is a child. So I think you're half correct, but I think half of the answer omits the fact that it is technically possible that someone who just communicates with a child, regardless of whether they reasonably believe that that's the case, would come within the statute here. I'm personally comfortable with the prosecutorial discretion argument. I just wanted to make sure that we got that out in the open. And, Mr. Chair, as long as I have the microphone, if I could ask one more question. I just want to make sure, too, on either First Amendment grounds or on, you know, overbreadth grounds, do you know the definition here of sexually explicit? Does this come from some other statute, either in Minnesota or elsewhere? I just want to make sure we're not sending up something that could get struck down for overbreadth. That's all. Especially
Boyd.
In this area, that's bound
Mr.
to happen
Boyd.
Sometimes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I can't tell you off the top of my head exactly what statute it came from, but it was modeled after a statute in another state.
I just want to point out to Detective Martin, I completely agree with you on the reasonable belief. If what you were stating here today is what the statute did, I'd have absolutely no problem with it. However, the statute goes beyond that, way off. And that's why I'm very concerned about the language. In fact, I think that it's my belief that we basically could prosecute anybody on the Internet under this. I mean, basically, anybody that sends this out on the Internet could be prosecuted, it seems like. Representative Holberg?
And Mr. Chair, I agree, and with all due respect to Representative Simon, words do matter. And prosecutorial discretion, okay with you, it's not okay with me. And year after year, the longer I'm here, virtually every year we have bills that come in to address unintended consequences. This committee has addressed a flaw in this language. They said it was listed from the solicitation statutes. The current solicitation statutes relate to a face-to-face encounter in which there is information there on whether or not you reasonably believe that you're dealing with an adult or not. There is no face-to-face on the Internet. And the scenario that you laid out is not addressed in this bill. I think it can be done probably with one or two lines and, you know, providing for that in the bill. But it is an important bill. I think that we need to do it right. I don't think it's going to, you know, you guys are smart people. You deal with this all the time. But these, the response relative to the actor reasonably believes is a child, you know, it's not an and, it's an or. So the actor could definitely communicate in a sexually explicit manner with a child, which when you get up to 2.3, it says with a child or someone. There's no mitigating description of a child. And so they would be guilty of this if you had a 15-year-old pretending to be a 21-year-old trying to meet somebody at a club and talking in a sexually explicit manner. And I think it does matter what we put into our books, that situation is addressed with some kind of language.
Well, Representative Holberg, I think your point about prosecutorial discretion being safe, I served on this committee my first 4 years here, and we were continually promised by prosecutors that the language was okay because they would, no prosecutor would ever charge something. And every single time they said that in the 4 years I was here, some prosecutor charged it within a year after that. So I'm not that... Representative Kale... Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out that in line 1.15, when it's to line 1.22, it is actually identical when you're talking about soliciting by mail, by telephone, by letter. And so it already currently is in statute about other means. And so if you're mailing someone a letter, you maybe didn't see them. If you're talking to them on the telephone, you maybe didn't see them as well. And so it is currently already in statute about a number of other ways of communicating. I just wanted to point that out to the committee.
But Representative Hillstrom, I think it should also be pointed out. Oh, that is correct. I'm sorry. Reverend Flash is true.
I just want to make a point to that, to the point that was previously raised, Mr. Chair, and that's that I just want to remind members of the committee that the punishment is not being prosecuted. The punishment comes after you are convicted of these crimes, and in some cases we need to rely on the trier of fact to determine whether or not they reasonably believe this would happen. We rely on prosecutorial discretion for certain areas where it is difficult. There are those nuanced areas where you don't really know, and we in the committee worry about, well, what about that person that gets gill-netted who is an innocent bystander? And in this case, obviously in criminal law matters, we hope that we'll let 10 guilty people go free before we put one innocent person in jail. Nonetheless, the Attorney General here and Representative Hillstrom are asking for an additional tool for this, and I think it's important to remember that the worst-case scenario should not, I think those of us who are looking at enacting criminal law policy, the worst case scenario should not be that person who gets prosecuted who shouldn't be. The worst case scenario should be that person who gets convicted who shouldn't be.
I represent Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom, I also want to thank you for bringing this bill, and I think this thoughtful discussion about the language. I'm actually reminded of a discussion I had about 7 weeks ago with a couple of folks who work specifically with sex offenders in our correction system. And I was just sort of bouncing a couple of statistics that came my way across them. And he said, you know, the thing to remember is that 6 out of 7 sex offenders in the correctional system had no prior sex-related offense. And what's happening with the problem that this bill is trying to address is we have sex offenders who are volunteering, who are self-identifying their behavior in ways that we didn't catch before. So we are catching more and more of people who are stepping forward. And, you know, my training in architecture says think to scale. This bill is a phenomenal jump in terms of the scale of intervention that we can do before the problem occurs, before it gets worse, before we have young people being predated upon. I think it's a really good bill. I think that Representative Lesh articulated very clearly maybe the 1 out of 1 million possibility here is that we might have, you know, one person prosecuted because of some runaway prosecutor, but the trier of fact will correct that and catch it. It's a very, very good bill.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had one follow-up to Representative Simon's question. He raises a good point. I mean, we're not going to give anybody a tool if this statute is struck down on any grounds. And I wanted to go back for a moment to lines 1.18 and 1.19, and this is rather broad language. Any communication that relates to sexual conduct falls within the scope of this bill. And I apologize to the Attorney General's office if I missed your response, but again, where did this language come from? Is it defined elsewhere in statute, or is there any decisional authority out there in any other jurisdiction that has passed upon this language? Because again, it raises a concern to Representative Simon, obviously, and myself, that you may get challenged on overbreath grounds right off the bat.
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the part of the statute that eliminates that danger is the intent requirement. Yes, it's the definition of sexually explicit is broad, and that is intentionally so. But a person can't be convicted for sexually explicit communication with a child unless the prosecutor also proves the intent to gratify the sexual desire of that person or the child. So, you know, to a large extent, if something is borderline in this definition of sexually explicit, it's going to be very difficult to meet the intent element.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Voigt, I have a question. Is there no way that you could design language that would allow mistake as to age to be a defense? If it was, is it impossible to define it narrowly?
Mr. Chair, it can probably be done. The difficulty with it, though, is to come up with language that doesn't make it too easy for the offender to simply say, I didn't know who I was speaking with, or I didn't know who I was soliciting.
There was language just suggested, Mr. Voigt, that would mistake as to age as a defense to a prosecution under 2A. Would that be impossible to use? Would that make them,
Mr. Chair, where?
Different?
Where would that go? Or
it would be under at line 216.
Mr. Chair, we do have a different suggestion.
Representative Hildstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could have Mr. Voigt talk about another possibility.
Mr. Chair, the way I see to eliminate the strict liability, the strict liability in the statute that is causing the concerns would be in all of the phrases in subdivision 2A, in A, B, and C, simply delete the phrase a child or, and leave the prohibition simply as someone the actor reasonably believes is a child.
Mr. Voigt, that's the suggestion I made about 3 hours ago, or 4 hours ago.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want the committee to understand that, you know, with alcohol, when an adult gives someone who's underage alcohol, we don't care if they don't know what age they are. If they give it, they're guilty. And so what the committee would be doing is making the choice to say, you know, you didn't know, and we think that's okay. But when people are committing a crime like this, they're always going to say, oh, I didn't know. And as I've watched the Dateline show over and over and over again, every single one of these people that came to the house that they were trying to solicit always said, when Dateline was sitting there, I didn't know. Well, she told you on the internet that what her age was. I didn't really believe her because she wouldn't be talking like that if she were over the age. And so this committee is actually making a real decision that they're saying that the person has to know. And, you know, we prefer to say, look, if you're making that proposition and you're doing it to a child, you ought to know better. And so the committee would be making the decision.
Well, Representative Filstrom, I know the decision they're making, but the comparison to the alcohol is totally different because that's in person. Representative Simon.
Well, Mr. Chair, if it's appropriate this time, I have maybe another suggestion, which I think would preserve that portion of the bill, which I think is potentially important. Would it make sense, and here I should rely on Representative Lesh and others who have maybe had to make these decisions, but I don't remember from way back when, is mistake of fact, is that judged by an objective or a subjective standard? Is there a way to do a mistake of age defense that is objective, not subjective? Not, in other words, they're not off the hook if they say, oh, I didn't know. They're only off the hook if a trier of fact, as Representative Lesh has pointed out, judges based on the facts and circumstances that a reasonable person would have or should have known. In other words, can we craft an objective standard mistake of age defense, or is that just not what you do with mistake of fact? I guess that's partially a question for Representative Lesh or others who might know, maybe staff.
I would guess Mr. Voigt, being a prosecutor for the AG, would...
That's a good point, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Voigt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I'm trying to think of an example in which we have an exception based upon reasonable belief, and I can't definitively tell you we don't have one. I'm just not, there's not one coming to mind.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Representative Lesh.
Well, I wanted to address Representative Simon. Mistake of fact is an affirmative defense in criminal. It's laid out in the jury instruction guides, but it does not explicitly say, as I recall in the jury instruction guides, whether it's objective or subjective. It's a question for the trier of fact. So it's just flat out, you don't believe it, you don't believe it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holbert.
Representative Hilstrom, are you in a big hurry to move this bill? I mean, my experience on these kinds of issues is that there will be a solution found, and that in a committee hearing with all these people, it's probably not the best place to do it, putting people on the spot. Maybe it makes sense to lay this over, you know, give people a day to try and find some language that addresses the chair's concerns, put it at the top of the agenda on Thursday, and get it out of here.
Representative Holbrook, there's... It doesn't have to go to any other committees. It eventually has to go to... It doesn't go to Representative Paymark's committee. It goes to Representative Carlson, who's sitting behind you, his committee finance. But I don't see any... Representative Hilstrom?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that it does have that impact, and so that it would have to go to Representative Paymark's committee.
Well, Representative Hilstrom, it doesn't go directly. It goes to Representative Carlson's finance committee first. He refers it down then afterwards. Representative Holbrook, would you like to make a motion to?
Mr. Chair, you're the committee. You can lay
it
on the table without a motion.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just trying to expedite our hearing here so we have another bill. I mean, I've just found in the past that this is not the best way, especially with the nuances of this issue that we're trying to address, to come up with the right language.
I think you're... I guess I'm going to... I really have a real problem with this language. It's anybody can be convicted in the country with this, not just in Minnesota. And I guess I'm going to lay this over for to try and work out, see if there's some kind of language where we can get at this really horrible activity and yet not bring somebody in and let other prosecutors somehow sometimes try to make a name for themselves or whatever and do that.
Mr. Chair, just before you do that, we do have one other suggestion that you'd think would be fine if you would want to consider this one last suggestion if you'd like to address this.
Mr. Boyd.
Well, Mr. Chair, the other way to reach the concern, the strict liability concern, is to amend Subdivision 3, as I think someone suggested. Mistake of age is not a defense to a prosecution under Subdivision 2. It still leaves the possibility of a mistake of age defense under Subdivision 3, or excuse me, Subdivision 2A, which is the amendment.
So it would be mistake of age is not a defense to a prosecution under Subdivision 2, is that correct?
That's correct.
That was what Mr. Diebel had suggested, basically.
Mr. Chairman, would you be fine with that?
Proceed for now. Proceed.
Okay. Is that acceptable to those with concerns on the committee? Okay, is there any other questions? No. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes, we would have to move the amendment. Representative Hillstrom, do you want to move that amendment?
Yes, I would move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Do you have? Could you restate it, Mr. Voigt?
The amendment would, under Subdivision 3, it would eliminate the last two words, this section, and replace them with Subdivision 2.
Does everybody understand the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Or Representative Westman?
Just a clarification, then, that we would say it doesn't apply in one provision, but by default, then it does apply, or is it clear that it does apply in the other provisions?
Well, Mr. Boyd, I was... Go ahead. What do you think?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's the way that I would interpret it. If you wanted to make that explicit, you could also add a sentence that mistake as to age is an affirmative defense as to Subdivision 2A.
Mr. Chair, that would just be my question, is the fact that it does stipulate that that's the defense.
Representative Westrom and Hillstrom, Mr. Voigt, Mr. Diebel suggested that we could add also to make it clear, mistake as to age is a defense to a prosecution under Subdivision 2A, to make it clear. Is that...
I think that's what we're trying to achieve, and I would support achieving that, Mr. Chair. I think we should look at maybe clarifying that.
He just added another.
Okay.
It's an affirmative defense. Is that... okay, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Now, are there any questions left on the bill? Okay, all in favor, and the motion is to send it to Representative Carlson's Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, this House file is 950, and I think your staff was provided with an amendment to get it in the order that we'd like to present it. Would be amendment A070104.
Representative Carlson, yes, we do have, I believe everybody has that. Representative Carlson, I will move amendment 0104 to get it in the shape you want as an author's amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Go ahead and present your bill.
Mr. Chairman, this is one that will have to go to the Finance Committee when you get to the point of making a referral motion.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Carlson, I forgot you're not on the committee. I'll move your bill and to send it to you.
Okay. And
we'll have to, because I didn't do that first, I'll have to go over the vote for the amendment again, and I'll move the amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. No, sorry. Okay. No, you're on.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is before us to correct an error, and it's a bill that's before us upon the request of the Hennepin County District Court. During the 2006 legislature, the judicial branch pursued a cleanup bill to remove obsolete references and provisions, and the bill was then added to the omnibus bill. And an incorrect repealer in the omnibus bill led to the unintentional repeal of a 1963 law that was unique to Hennepin County. The repeal law required Hennepin County District Court to disperse non-felony forfeited bail to the municipalities in which the offense occurred. And since July 1, 2006, these bail proceeds have been mistakenly credited to the State General Fund. A companion 1963 law that was not repealed requires the municipalities in Hennepin County to pay the Hennepin County Workhouse for the incarceration of Mr. Meenans. And the bail proceeds were intended to help the municipalities pay these incarceration costs. And the solution then, Mr. Chairman, would be to restore and update the repealed 1963 law. To reclaim these funds would have a fiscal impact then, as the bill is structured, of $240,000 this year, and then $240,000 each year of the next biennium. And one of the reasons that I would like to get this over to the Finance Committee, if this committee favorably acts on the request, would be to perhaps address this year's deficiency with the deficiency bill that's currently in the Finance Committee. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would just point out that the supporters are the Minnesota Judicial Council, the municipalities and subdivisions of government in Hennepin County, and would just mention that both the Senate Committee on Judiciary and the Senate Judiciary Budget Division have approved a companion bill as of a few minutes ago.
That's correct.
So I would like to turn the podium, if I could, then over to Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Thompson. Members, thank you. My name is Mark Thompson, the Hennepin County Court Administrator. Hennepin County, unlike the other 86 counties, and it seems like this happens periodically, but it again is before you today, has a unique relationship where if you're a misdemeanant and you're prosecuted by a municipality in Hennepin County and you go to the workhouse overnight, the municipality pays the per diem to the workhouse. The other 86 counties in the state don't have that relationship. The bail consideration, that is the forfeited bail that was to go back to the municipalities and in fact did from 1963 until 2006 at the time of this errant repeal, was to offset some of those costs. Now, it's not a good deal for the municipalities because the costs are about $1.1 million per year collectively for the 47 municipalities to put all these misdemeanants in the workhouse. That's what they pay to the county. They only get back about $250,000 per year. So it's about a quarter of their actual expense, which is unique to the municipalities. So if you go to Anoka County and Columbia Heights prosecutes a person for a misdemeanor and they go to the Anoka County jail, they don't pay for that. In Hennepin County, they would. That's the difference between the 86 counties and Hennepin County. That's why when this was repealed, it was errant for Hennepin County.
Are there any questions on this? Representative Famer.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how did you come up with the $200,000 figure?
Mr. Thompson? On an annual basis, it's about $247,000, just under $250,000, Representative Tamar, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, why don't you make that request instead of saying approximately?
It's a little hard, as I understand it, Mr. Chairman, predict. It's settled up, if I recall correctly, at the end of the year, and that 240 is based on the history of what has transpired in the past.
That's correct. And there is
Mr. Thompson,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tamar. There is Senate language that's identical to this, and we are working on the exact figure for the finance resolution.
So, Mr. Chair, maybe this, I don't know if I should wait until it gets to the Finance Committee, but so did I understand this correctly? So this is just for this biennium, or is this to correct the mistake that was made?
Representative Price.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, this is to correct a mistake that was made, and so if the bill passes, I will have an amendment in the Finance Committee that would correct the problem for this year. That would be $240,000 approximately, and the fiscal note shows $240,000. But then, when the new policy or the old policy is reinstated, then that would carry forward into the next biennium, as I mentioned during my presentation, and that would be approximately $480,000 for the next biennium. And Mr. Chairman, if that repeal hadn't taken place, if that error hadn't happened, that would be money that, instead of going into the general fund as it is now, would have been going to the municipalities in Hennepin County for their costs with the Hennepin County Workhouse.
Are there any other questions? Okay, looks like all in favor of the bill say aye.
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 All opposed? Carries. It's referred to your Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Representative Immer moves the. Oh, did you do that? Oh, okay. Did that. Okay, then we're adjourned.